This is attached.
Okay, so we can go ahead and go
to Good evening. This is the December meeting of the County Health Commission, and welcome everybody. The first item of business will be the approval of the minutes of last meeting. Are there any changes or corrections to the minutes? All right, then there being no changes or corrections, the minutes will stand as written and published. Next order of business is public comment. Anyone who wishes to make a comment has 3 minutes to do so. Please state your name.
Thank you, Chairman Enns. My name is Jesse Arnold. I live in Cambria. My general subject is genetic engineering and the need for a precautionary moratorium on that subject. But more specifically, the chairman asked me to talk about Brown Act violations by this commission at last meeting. So I have two I'll mention. One, I believe the choice of the members for the GMO task force was done in such a secret way that that violated the Brown Act. The other one was when we came in to talk about the three reports that eventually came before your commission, the task force report, the GE Free Citizens response, and then a report from Santa Cruz County, that public comment, instead of 3 minutes per person, was limited to 1 minute. And I realize that wasn't technically a violation of the Brown Act because people were allowed to speak. Nevertheless, cutting our time that much, I believe, was a violation of the spirit of the Brown Act. And the tenor was that somebody here just didn't want to hear an opposing viewpoint, and I think that's unfortunate. So there was really no discussion, or I shouldn't say no discussion, but very little discussion of any of the reports. And certainly in defense of the citizens' report, to date, no one has challenged any of the information that was put forward in that report. No one has said this is factual error in that report. And the citizens felt they had to do that because things were not listed in the GMO task force report. And so citizens had to step up and put those facts before the public. And as you all know, this commission voted to accept all three of the reports, which I think pretty well tells everyone that the other two reports were worthy of being looked at, and that perhaps the GMO task force was not as, let's say, unbiased as it was cooked up to be. Even in the GMO task force report, they admitted that federal regulators do not look at the raw data that the genetic engineering companies work up. In other words, we're being asked to take it on faith. The companies cook up their experiments. They don't really tell the government what the results were, and we're expected to take it on faith. And I don't think responsible citizens should be taking it on faith. Thank you for the opportunity to speak.
Thank you for your comments, and Merry Christmas, Jesse.
Elizabeth Johnson, San Luis Obispo. I heard y'all were upset about the ethics stuff last month. In last month's Health Commission public comment, Chairwoman Enns said that, quote, any person who feels there was a violation of the Brown Act should be specific about the violation, and they want to contact County Council, unquote. County Council does not talk to or advise mere citizens. So I will present my specifics here and now. It took me 5 minutes to list 16 clear violations of the Brown Act, 15 of those violations being perpetrated by Chairwoman Enns in her capacity as chair of the GMO Task Force, and one by Task Force Vice Chair Scott Steinmuss during a meeting that he chaired in 2006. A list of violations accompanies my comments. The chair cannot plead ignorance of these violations because she attended the August 8, 2005 Health Commission retreat as the newly elected Health Commission chair. The speaker was Deputy County Counsel Warren Jensen, and his PowerPoint presentation focused on two topics, the Brown Act, or open meeting law, and conflict of interest laws. Mr. Jensen stated, quote, beyond doubt, the Health Commission is required to comply with the Brown Act, unquote. The requirements include all meetings must be noted with an agenda, meetings limited to the agenda, public participation must be allowed, no secret meetings, grounds for a closed meeting are extremely unlikely. The second half of his talk pertained to conflicts of interest. We know that some task force members received money from industries who stood to benefit from a pro-GMO position, but no members made these disclosures until they were pressured to do so, and even then lied or minimized the connections. Conflicts of interest laws are ruled by the general statement that one cannot serve two masters, and a severe case of this should completely disqualify an individual from participating in public process. During the GMO task force, taking it as a measure, I'm sure we could assemble a long and dishonorable list of violations of conflict of interest, including the chair's corporate ag in-laws. You are meeting now in the Board of Supervisors' chambers. You are being taped for viewers at home and for the public record. You are public officials. You are accountable to the public to behave at the minimum standards of ethical behavior. You're required to disclose conflicts of interest. If you don't want ethics that come with being a public official, you should now follow Chairwoman Enns and Vice Chair Hicks out the door so that your seat will be filled by someone committed to an ethical and transparent government that serves all citizens. And Merry Christmas to those of you who believe in transparent democracy. Thank you.
And Merry Christmas to you, Elizabeth.
Hi, my name is Mark Phillips. I'm from Atascadero, and Merry Christmas to everybody. The May 6th Health Commission meeting, Dr. Steinmaß was summarizing his objections with the research of Dr. Arpad Pusztai when he stated, quote, we tried to assess these differences with Arpad himself, and the responses I got personally, I didn't understand. I ran it by other plant molecular biologists like National Academy of Scientists members Robert Goldberg and Kent Bradford, and they didn't know what these responses mean either. In the text of the GE Task Force report, Dr. Steinmaß references his personal communication when he says, quote, in an attempt to rectify this issue, members of this panel, Steinmaß and Broadhurst, attempted to assess Pusztai's claims directly. Pusztai's response to the question, how did you transform the GM potatoes used in your experiments, Pusztai replied, internodal stem fragment propagation, which indicates that he did not perform the original transformation event, does not know about the original transformation event, or will not tell us about the original transformation event. And then he references his Steinmaß personal communication. The problem here is that neither Scott nor Michael Broadhurst nor anyone else at the from the GM GE task force ever contacted Dr. Pusztai. I was the only one who contacted Dr. Pusztai, and I had a long correspondence with him on several issues. He was always very forthcoming in his responses. I had asked Dr. Pusztai how he generated his potatoes, and he had told me internodal stem fragment propagation, and I passed this information along to Dr. Steinmaß, thinking that this was adequate for his purposes. He never came back to me and asked another question, and he never asked Dr. Pusztai another question. So what he took to these other scientists that he says he discussed with them, I have no idea. But clearly, he's tried to make us believe that he had some contact with Dr. Pusztai, which never occurred. Instead, he just uses this lack of a response to further criticize Dr. Pusztai. This is just another in a long series of deceptions perpetrated on the public by Dr. Steinmaß. And now we have a situation where we've already been discussing for the last several months the lie that that Lynn Enns has said regarding SLOGE-free, trying to slander us. She was the chair of the GE task force. Now we have Dr. Steinmaß, who was the vice chair of the GE task force, doing the same sort of thing, criticizing Pusztai when he never even talked to him, and trying to make us all believe that he did. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that this is the type of environment we were trying to deal with when we were trying to get our information to the GE task force. Clearly, they didn't want to listen to anything we had to say. You'll note that the GE task force report does not include any of the information that I presented to the task force that showed support and recognition of the value of Dr. Pusztai's research. Instead, Steinmaus took it upon himself to just eliminate that all from the record. Merry Christmas.
Thank you, Mark. Is there anybody else who would like to make a public comment? All right, then. We'll move on to the presentations from our local nonprofit charitable organizations, as is our tradition in December. And so first we have Lisa Frazier from the San Luis Obispo Child Abuse Prevention. Thank you for being here, Lisa.
Thank you, Chairman Enns, for letting me step before my colleagues here. I have a football banquet to attend. It's that time of the year. My name is Lisa Frazier. I have been directing the San Luis Obispo County Child Abuse Prevention Council now for 6 years. We are a nonprofit 501c that works to put out the projects and the programs that I'm going to show you right now. This is a picture of our board of directors we just recently took at our annual breakfast. And I just wanted to remind the commission that the Child Abuse Prevention Council is mandated to operate under the Welfare and Institution Codes, and we have been doing that since 1987. We also encourage and facilitate training for the professionals in the detection and treatment of the prevention of child abuse and neglect, and we also are aware that, I want to point out that about 1,200 plus children in this county do suffer from abuse and neglect. These are statistics from the Child Welfare Services Division. This is one of our projects that we put out in the county. It's called Talk About Touching. It's a safe personal safety program. We reach about 1,800 kindergarten age children every year by doing this outreach. We also, there's the Baby Think It Over project. We've been doing this now since 1998. We take this into all the high schools and all the middle schools. We are also aligned with the Attorney General's Office from Safe from the Start, where we reach out on the reducing the violence of how children, when they're exposed to violence, how it affects their development. Our public forums, our mandated reporter trainings, we do that and reach out to the 25,000 plus professionals in our county that are mandated by law to report suspected child abuse in San Luis Obispo County. We also oversee the postpartum depression support line services, and this has been operating since 1998, and we do that with the support of the First Five Commission of San Luis Obispo County. In addition to that, we also are a primary partner in bringing Martha's Place, the Children's Assessment Center, here, which will be operating in January of 07. And we also are formed in a collaborative to bring about awareness about alcohol, tobacco, and drugs that affect a child's well-being before, during, and after pregnancy. And our public awareness activities. This is a Cal Poly project we do annually, where the students actually create media information for us. And I'm going to skip because I know I'm running out of time. But I want to make the commission aware that we're going forward with a parent leadership training. We're going to affect how parents sit on commission and boards and policy-making panels in the future. We also are going to advance the establishment of emerging and family resource centers in San Luis Obispo County.
And we're not timing you.
That's okay. Okay, I thought we were being timed. I'm sorry. And also, I'm also involved with facilitating two regional trainings this year to improve the operational capacity of the child death review teams in San Luis Obispo County, Santa Barbara, and Ventura counties. So thank you. Thank you very much. If you have any questions, I'm happy to answer them.
Thank you, Lisa. And how would someone contact if they want to help? What's your phone number?
Our number is 543-6216, and we operate Monday through Friday in the office.
Okay, thank you very much. Does anybody have any questions of Lisa? Any questions from commissioners? All right.
Thank you
very much for being here, Lisa. We appreciate that you carved out this little space of time for us. Edie Kahn is here from Aid Support Network. Edie, can you give us the phone number of your, when you get up and, oh, you got all the phone numbers. Okay. Never mind then.
Once again, thanks to the Health Commission for giving of your time each year to nonprofit agencies so that we can let you and those watching know about what each of us does in the community and what new activities, challenges, and successes we've had in the last year. My name is Edie Kahn, and I'm the Executive Director of the San Luis Obispo County AIDS Support Network and Slow Hep C Project, and I'd like to give you an overview of what we do in each of the programs. The AIDS Support Network, or ASN, mission is to serve the needs of clients who are living with HIV disease and AIDS throughout our county, as well as to educate the community about HIV and AIDS. Established 22 years ago, the agency has grown considerably from its all-volunteer roots, serving only about 20 clients. Now we are serving 145 clients living with HIV or AIDS, and like most nonprofits, receive a unique patchwork of funding that helps us provide our services, from federal grants to local grants. Unlike some agencies, ASN provides a team case management approach. Our social services team focuses on three major areas. Our health counselor is our liaison between the medical world and our clients, as well as a risk reduction educator. Our benefits counselor and AIDS drug assistance program coordinator helps our clients connect to vital programs that can help provide income, insurance coverage, and medications. The housing services coordinator works to find affordable housing for homeless clients and keeps our low-income clients in their homes with all utilities in place. In addition to those services, ASN still maintains a large and active pool of volunteers to take care of the needs that may not fall into our three focus areas. Things like a ride to the doctor, help with house cleaning, a friendly phone call, or needed home repairs. ASN also works in our community to educate about HIV prevention and risk reduction, with programs for high-risk groups, men who have sex with men, as well as teens and young adults, and risk reduction programs specifically for people who are already diagnosed HIV positive. Since 2000, the ASN has started providing services for people living with Hep C through the Slow Hep C Project, a program ideally patterned very much after our HIV services. As soon as the Slow Hep C Project opened its doors, we began to see how deeply hepatitis C has impacted the county. We have seen well over 500 clients in the last 5 years and are now maintaining an active client base of just over 325. Hep C is a disease that is still under the radar in our country and unfortunately is sparsely funded. We still can offer health and benefits counseling, our volunteer services, and community education, but are severely limited on direct financial assistance for housing, mental health counseling, lab work, and other items. Our valuable partnerships throughout the county's nonprofits help us connect our clients to housing assistance, utility payments, and low-cost counseling, etc., when we can't. We hope that in time our funding levels will equal our HIV program funding levels so that we can provide a fuller slate of services to these clients. Our food pantry is our most utilized service, and we're able to provide staples to all of our clients. Partnering with the Food Bank Coalition, we purchase food or food is donated for our clients. As you can see, we provided well over 33,000 meals this year for clients. As clients come in, it's also an easy spot for our staff to touch base, and in many instances, that one connection can stave off emerging problems in other areas. What are our challenges? I've listed a few that come to mind, but would like to focus on one in particular. As with many providers in our county, ASN and Slo Hep C staff is seeing a dramatic rise in the number of people who are using methamphetamines. Erratic behavior and mood swings cause these clients to be very difficult to work with. With no in-house detox in our county, it's also very difficult to find a lasting solution to their drug problems. What about successes? As you can see, we've helped stabilize 312 individuals in permanent housing through our programs and through the programs in the community. Our team has case managed 263 clients on an intensive basis over the last year. We're strengthening our ties with CHCCC to provide better services for our clients. And referencing our challenges, ASN pulled together the first Meth Town Hall meetings to begin a dialogue about a community response to a community problem. I know this is also an opportunity for us to appeal to our community for support, and I'd like to take the opportunity first to thank our community members for their ongoing support as volunteers and as donors. People still find time and find charitable contributions to give to all of our local nonprofits, including ASN and the Slo Hep C Project. I've listed a couple ways people can lend a hand to our agency. Please know that all your donations are tremendously meaningful. Your time as a volunteer, food for our food pantry, or a monetary donation. Please visit our websites, www.asn.org and www.slohepc.org, for more information on our services and ways that you can help. We thank you and wish you all happy holidays.
Thank you very much, Edie. Are there any questions from commissioners? Okay, well, Commissioner Donnelly.
Hello?
Hey, it works. I just have a quick question. You had mentioned about that you collect food and stuff for your clients. Do you also do you work with the food bank or the homeless shelter?
Yes, we
do you
connect,
guys work and connect?
Yes, we connect, especially with the Food Bank Coalition.
Okay.
They are one of our major suppliers of food.
Okay.
And then we do a lot of volunteer food drives for clients, and we get some grants that are specific to food, for food line items, so that we purchase food that way, things that we can't necessarily get at the Food Bank Coalition.
Okay.
So that's how we do it.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Commissioner Schmuses?
The little button.
Hello? Okay. Thank you. Sorry, Edie. When you mentioned one of your bullet points was intensively managed, case managed, can you, in 150 words or less, differentiate between intensive case management and your other?
Well, you know, sometimes we're seeing clients and we see them just on a basis where they come in with one problem. They need assistance with a utility bill or something like that. And we see them, we solve a problem, we may not see them again for a couple months. A lot of our clients, however, require a lot of different services and a real team approach. So we have problems with healthcare, problems with connecting to those benefits that I listed, problems making sure that the person is stable in their household. And so those are the clients that we're working on, sort of the whole picture for. So that's what we're calling intensive case management.
Thank you very much. There's no further questions. We'll welcome Carl Hansen from the Food Bank Coalition.
Madam Chair, members of the Commission, I want to thank you for inviting me to come on behalf of the Food Bank tonight. It was just a year ago, almost to the day, that I was on the job a few days when I made my first appearance before you, so I've learned a lot in this past year. I want to try to focus my remarks on some of the major accomplishments that we've made during this past year and what our priorities have been, along with my learning how a food bank works and what my role in that would be. One of the primary things we've been able to do is to increase the nutritional value and accessibility of nutritious food to the now 130 agencies that we serve as with Edie's AIDS agency and others around the county by being able to give fresh fruit and vegetables to them free, whereas in the past we had to charge a shared maintenance for that product. We've also been able to expand our resources for fresh fruit and vegetables brought into the county from outside the county, and been able to distribute those throughout the county. We've been able to help the children of our county in a small way so far, over and above what we've always done through our USDA distributions and through the agencies, by initiating a backpack program, which is a partnership with the public schools so that when low-income children who are identified by school administration are sent home on the weekend, provision of nutritious food will continue that they receive when they're at school during the week, over the weekend. So we provide the food and the backpacks. They help us by identifying the children and administering the program, much as an agency would do. And these children are given enough food to not entirely give them three square meals a day plus snacks, but about four meals plus snacks over the course of the weekend. And so in that way, we're assuring that when they come back to school on Monday, they will have been fed well, and they'll be ready to go to work and do well in school, because they haven't had at the risk of being hungry over the weekend or not having nutritious food available to them. Very recently, as you probably have read in the newspaper, we've incorporated the operation of Harvest Bag into the food bank, which was really at their request and their invitation, I should say. And we were very grateful to have the opportunity to work with them. And now Harvest Bag is functioning out of our warehouse in Oceano, which is a bit chaotic, but we've been able to close their warehouse and enjoy the economies of having one operation and giving them the kind of support with our staff and the kind of financial background that they need in order to continue the wonderful work that's been going on through Harvest Bag for the last 30 years. So I think this has been a real movement forward in terms of the quality of care that's and what's being offered to low-income people around the county. So those are some of the, you know, just some of the really three things that I want to touch on. And I'll stop there and see if you have any questions about what the food bank's doing at this time.
Are there questions from any of the commissioners? Question from Dr. Thomas.
I'd like to acknowledge in Mr. Hansen's participation in the Obesity Prevention Task Force. We think of food shortage perhaps as leading to malnutrition, but there's a good evidence also that those that are hungry often look to the least expensive carbohydrates to fill up with, and therefore obesity and imperfect nutrition as a result. So Carl gave a presentation to the task force, which was very well received and has been there participating with us, so we appreciate it very much. It's the kind of the other side of the issue, but not really.
Yes. Well, thank you, Dr. Thomas. And I will say that our board is quite aware of my participation in that, and we're looking forward to stretching our capabilities to accommodate whatever comes out of that task force in terms of how the food bank can participate in more nutritious food for young people especially.
That's a wonderful example of how agencies can work together. Any other questions from commissioners for Carl Hansen? Okay, thank you very much for being here. And now I would like to welcome Donna Keene from Hospice of San Luis Obispo.
Thank you, commissioners, for the time for nonprofits this evening and for the thoughtful work that you do. Yes, I'm Donna Keene. I'm the director of Hospice of San Luis Obispo County. We're our county's only volunteer hospice, and we've been in the community for 29 years. We provide non-medical, emotional, social, and spiritual support to children and adults of all ages who are grieving or living with life-threatening illness. We do not charge for any of our clients' services, and many of them now are provided in Spanish as well as English. And our primary programs consist of the in-home respite care, where we send trained volunteers to the homes of families who are dealing with a life-threatening or terminal illness, and they provide emotional support, practical assistance, transportation, light housekeeping, and a very understanding year. Our bereavement counseling is a very large and comprehensive program. We see over 1,000 individuals each year through grief support, which consists of individual, couple, family, child, and teen counseling. And so far this year, we're at about 750 individuals. And I think what often is surprising for people to know about our particular hospice is, yes, we deal a great deal with bereavement issues related to cancers and cardiac and major illnesses. But when I did ran the statistics for this year so far, right after cancer as a main cause of death for our counseling program, auto accident was next, and then suicide and drug overdose, and then after that is cardiac. So we deal with a great deal of traumatic life experiences, and we deal with them often early on in a loss, and we do this on a daily basis. Part of this program, also, we do community crisis response, and what I mean by that, if there's a sudden death at an area school or business, we have a team that goes in as a second line of support to the schools and businesses to help people get functional again, to process their experience, and mainly learn how they can support each other through the process. We do a lot of innovative projects that are very interesting for us to do. One of those is about 4 years ago, in collaboration with the California Men's Colony, we did our first inmate hospice-based volunteer program, where we trained inmates to be volunteers for each other and to help each other through the dying process. And this has been an incredibly successful program. And further circles around that have been attending to grief needs of inmates and offering memorial services. We also know it's very important to offer community education when it isn't a crisis or a traumatic experience. So we do a lot in that area. We do training in adult bereavement, child bereavement, and we work with book circles, Stephen Levine's A Year to Live, which gives the premise, if you had the luxury of knowing you had a year to live, how would you look at your life and your choices through that lens? And it's a wonderful book to kind of focus those choices and get people thinking about decisions they need to make and how they want to live their life. We also train professionals regularly and offer CEUs. We have an annual health and wellness conference in collaboration with AIDS Support Network and Sycamore Mineral Springs, and we bring in very well-known individuals. We had Andrew Weil at the PAC. Some of you may attend it a few years ago, and a lot of teachers in the psychology, Marion Woodman, Emmett Miller, so quite a range of well-known speakers, and that's very exciting to be a part of that, as well as training professionals. It's very interesting because there isn't a great deal in training to be a psychotherapist or MFT in the areas of grief and death and dying. And that's just such a fundamental training to have. So we do that on a regular basis. And in this very setting, once a year, we collaborate with other agencies for the annual suicide prevention forum. And actually, we've only had 2 years. We're now planning for our third year. And we think this is, again, such an important community message to energize people, to educate, to empower us. What can we do if we're in that position, a friend or neighbor tells us that they're thinking of suicide? So all these areas are a great deal of importance to hospice. We have a small staff of 8 FTEs, but over 85 trained volunteers in the counseling or in-home field. And in terms of office and fundraising, we probably have another 250, 300 that keep us going. We are 100% supported by the community through donations, annual fundraisers, grants, and United Way. We couldn't do it without the generosity of the volunteers, and we really appreciate the community's support financially and with the volunteer effort. Thank you.
Thank you very much. That was a very informative presentation. Are there any questions from commissioners? Okay, I think you said everything. Thank you very much. Next we have Tina McAvoy and Janet Jeffrey from Hospice Partners of the Central Coast.
Hello.
Welcome.
Thank you. I'm Tina McAvoy, and I'm the Director of Patient Care Services at Hospice Partners. This is Janet Jeffrey, and she's the administrator. Janet and I, first of all, want to thank you for having us here to present about our program. Hospice Partners of the Central Coast is the nonprofit, state-licensed, Medicare and Medi-Cal certified hospice agency that's based in San Luis Obispo County, and we serve the entire county as well as into northern Santa Barbara County. All activities of Hospice Partners are aimed at improving the existence and experience of those individuals facing the end of their life and those loving, living with them and caring for them. Hands-on patient care, symptom management, grief and bereavement services are our main business. Since no person who seeks our assistance is ever turned away, we also handle non-hospice grief crisis situations for survivors, things like sudden deaths, suicides, and we also provide palliative care consultative services, symptom management, for those people who either do not qualify for hospice or do not choose to be on a hospice program for one reason or another. We also provide those services in any place in the county where they live, which could be their home, a skilled nursing facility, assisted living. Our professional staff of 102 staff and volunteer staff of 145 are now providing quality end-of-life care to approximately 120 patients on any single given day, and this includes their family. Our work isn't just about how a person dies, it is about how they live. We focus on how our patients and their loved ones choose to live each day, and we provide comfort and guidance along the way. Our clients range in age from infants to over 100 years of age, and the diagnosis can include things like congenital defects, terminal cancer, end-stage cardiac and respiratory diseases, neuromuscular illnesses, and also something called debility, which is multi-system organ failure without any one specific cause. Our team includes nurses, physicians, social workers, bereavement counselors, therapists, home health aides, spiritual counselors, hospice musicians, volunteers, and we also now have homemaking services, dietitians as well. In addition, we partner with many schools in our area to as a training ground with nurses, home health aides, dietitians, spiritual counselors, and therapists. We create a compassionate atmosphere where patients are able to live with dignity, surrounded and supported by loved ones, so familiar friends and committed caregivers. We act as advocates to make sure that appropriate care and services are received. We provide these professional medical services 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. We have on-call availability, pain and symptom control, medications, and access to equipment 24 hours a day, every day of the week. To both our patients and our families, we provide emotional and spiritual support and bereavement care to the families for at least 13 months after the death of a loved one. And now Janet will.
Thank you. We consider ourselves to be an efficient and fiscally responsible nonprofit. Most of our patients are enrolled in some kind of an insurance program that has a hospice benefit, and the approximate breakdown today is 87% Medicare, 3.5% Medi-Cal, 8% private insurance, and 1.5% no insurance. General operating expenses that are deemed reimbursable by the federal government are covered by these insurances. We feel it's our duty to keep our general operating expenses at or below the Medicare reimbursement level. And so it's important for us to let the community know that we do not use contribution or grant money for those expenses. So what do we use the grant money for and contributions? Some hospice services are actually mandated by the government by licensing and certification, but not reimbursed by any of them. And those would include most volunteer department services and all bereavement services. Other services that are important for a quality program, though not mandated, that are either not reimbursed at all or inadequately reimbursed by insurance include medications, supplies, equipment, treatments for pain and symptom relief that exceed normal amounts, and those are called outliers. We had an outlier on service this last month, and she was hooked to three different pumps for pain management. Her drug bill, it probably is going to run somewhere in the neighborhood of $20,000 for a week and a half of care. That's an outlier. Also, hospice patients with no insurance. Hospice patients who are Medi-Cal clients who reside in skilled nursing facilities. All hospice musician services, all of our palliative care program services, and any community and professional education services. The total cost for all of those unreimbursed or poorly reimbursed services runs between $400,000 and $500,000 every year, which is 6 to 8% of our operating budget. About 2,000 people will die in our county this coming year, most expectedly from chronic illness. We anticipate we will care for about 50% of them. The good news is they don't have to die in pain or alone, and because of the generosity of the residents of this fabulous county, we will be able to continue to help anyone who calls us. Again, thank you for the opportunity to address the commission and the community tonight. We thank you for your support and happy holidays.
Thank you very much, ladies. Are there any questions? Commissioner Shimosis.
Yeah. Hi, thanks for your presentation. Appreciate it. Janet, would you please outline the primary differences between what you do and what Hospice of SLO does?
Yeah, well, I think Donna actually made the point pretty clear. Hospice of San Luis Obispo, is that still here? Yeah. Hospice of San Luis Obispo County is an all-volunteer organization. They are not licensed or certified, so they don't do any medical hands-on patient care. They don't employ nurses who actually go into the home and do the hands-on care. So that's the big difference. They are 100% funded by grants and contributions. We are a Medicare, Medi-Cal licensed certified agency, so we do bill for our services if clients have insurance, and most of our clients do, although it doesn't cover everything. So I think that we both do bereavement services. We both do community crisis services. We work cooperatively. What you might not know is 10% of our clients graduate every month. They get better. They're usually the non-cancer kinds of diagnoses. When they graduate off our program, then they may still need some volunteers. Well, in order to have volunteers, they have to be enrolled in our hospice program to have a hospice partners volunteer. So we then will turn around and call Hospice of San Luis Obispo, and some of the volunteers are volunteers for both programs, and that works really nicely. But if they're not, then Donna's agency finds the volunteer that fits in until the client reaches a point where they need hospice, licensed hospice care again. And so that's one example of how we work together. Did that answer your question?
Okay. Thank you for making that distinction clear. That I think a lot of people wonder about that. So I think we all understand that now. Thank you. Next, I'd like to welcome Karen Stinson from our Long-Term Care Ombudsman Service Program. Welcome, Karen.
Thank you. I have some handouts. I don't know the best way to distribute them.
Just hand them to us and we'll run them.
I think I've had the privilege of being here for about the last 7 years out of my 8 in the program, so I appreciate that you keep letting me come back. The Ombudsman Program in San Luis Obispo has been here since 1978. We were started by a lady up in Morro Bay once the federal and state legislation was enacted. So we have quite a few years of experience in the county. Our mission is to promote the highest possible quality of life and care for every resident of a long-term care facility. And what that really means is we want to make sure that people in care facilities are treated like the human beings that they are and not a patient or an injury or a wound or a medical condition. And the way we do that is we monitor the facilities, make sure that there's no health or safety issues going on, and that we make sure that any complaints about care or other problems are resolved as quickly as possible. And if we can't get them resolved by working with the facilities, then we send it off to another agency who can kind of force them to make the repairs that need to be made, whether it's a care issue or a health and safety. A couple of things that we find when we do facility monitoring visits are when we look for health and safety is we look at making sure the fire exits are clear. I have a nursing home that for the past several years has continually had an artificial tree placed in front of emergency exit. And while it's a lovely tree, it's not in the right spot. And we've had to go so far as to bring in the fire department to have that corrected. It finally disappeared recently after about 2 years of effort. And I'm very happy to say that tree's gone. I didn't take it. It's just gone. I'm not sure where it went. I should have. It was bad. And I think partly it was there because it helps the dementia patients not try to escape, but it also prevents other people from getting out, so it was a real problem. Another thing we found with health and safety issues is a couple weeks ago I was in a nursing home, and I found a full sharps container, which is the thing you put the needles and other sharp items into after they've become dirty or used. It had come off the wall for some reason, so it was placed in a basket at about waist level that anybody could walk away with. And of course, the dementia patients aren't always good at making sure they carry away good things that are healthy for them, so it was a real problem. We were able to have it fixed before we even left the building, which was very nice. It's very responsive. We look for those things. We also look for individual residents to make sure they look comfortable, that their call bells are being answered, that they're treated the way they're supposed to be treated. If they have concerns or questions about medications or anything like that, we help them look at their medical record. We'll talk with them. We'll talk with the staff. We really try to make sure everyone's being treated like the human being that they really are. Last year we looked at or investigated 333 complaints, and amongst that there was probably about 1,000 different items that we looked into, anywhere from cold food to abuse. And in California, we're one of 5 ombudsman programs in the nation that has the ombudsman program look into the abuse cases rather than go to Adult Protective Services. So it really is a huge undertaking that we make. We did 1,041 facility monitoring visits in our 9 skilled nursing facilities and 80 residential facilities. Federal law requires that we go into each building once a year. We don't really think that's enough. In fact, we're quite positive it's not enough because we have some openings in our volunteer corps right now. And the facilities that aren't getting visited as much, we're starting to get some very bad complaints about and some problems going on. So we know that they need to be visited at least once a week or once a month if it's a small facility. The things that our program could really use right now is the most is volunteers. We have our lowest number of volunteers ever right now. We're down to 15 for the whole county. Particularly the North County is we're getting a little limited up there. And we really need 25 to 30 people to really do a good job of what we're doing. It's really important to the residents that we be there. The other thing we need is publicity. it's very hard for people to remember our name or to find us in the phone book, because it's hard to decide if you should look under L for long-term care or O for ombudsman. And once you do find us, you got to remember the name, which is darn hard to spell and almost impossible to pronounce. So I don't have any control of the name. I can't change it. But as long as we're stuck with that, the more people can share information about us, which is why I gave you the little poster there. That's actually a small reprint of the poster that's in every facility in the county that's for long-term care. And we really have found that the more people call us before they begin the placement task, the better that their chances are that they're going to have a successful first placement. Or every time somebody's moved, they experience what's called transfer trauma, and it's not particularly healthy for them, particularly for folks who have dementia or memory loss issues. So what we try to do is match people up with facilities that are appropriate for their loved one. For instance, if somebody has dementia, they're probably not going to do really well in a large facility unless it's very mild dementia, because you get lost. You become part of the furniture, so to speak, with the staff. You know, you need a lot of direction to the dining room, to the activities. So we recommend a smaller facility for somebody with a lot of dementia if it's not, unless it's a specialized facility. And the same for somebody who doesn't get around very well. Somebody's not ambulatory, needs a lot of assistance getting somewhere. We highly recommend a smaller facility. On the opposite side, people who are pretty able to get around and don't have a lot of dementia tend to do better in larger facilities than in small. So we really try to help people match up the right facility for their needs. We also help people avoid facilities they should not be in. We have at least three or four residential facilities who've had significant problems taking in people who have dementia, and they have no ability to take care of dementia. They've had no training, they don't know what they're doing, and the person with dementia gets hurt. And we have one that's in jeopardy of losing their license right now and probably should lose it because of the problems that have gone on there. So we really try to make sure people have a very successful first placement. And if they call us first, it tends to be more successful for them. It also connects them with us sooner so that they can avoid unwanted evictions or unnecessary evictions, and also problems with their rights being violated. What our clients need at this point is volunteers and more staff in facilities. If we can't get more staff, it's not required by licensing. Most of the buildings are staffed appropriately for the regulations. Then what we really need is more volunteers, people to go to the nursing homes, to the residential facilities, and just visit with them. A lot of times, once somebody's out of the community, they get placed, all the other services stop. It's very hard to get caring callers or anybody like that into a facility because they're not funded for that. We have been very fortunate with hospice, both the hospices, of providing services, but they're one of the few that does for people in facilities. I mean, they really still need that socialization. They haven't left the community. They're still here. And like everybody in the county, our facility residents also need a lot more medical services, dental, eye, and psychiatrists are the real shortage we have in facilities. So if in your efforts to advocate, while we're getting all the other physicians we need in the county, we need those, particularly for the folks in facilities. And I'll take any questions if you have any.
Are there any questions from Commissioner Donnelly?
You had mentioned that it's best if a patient that's going into a long-term care facility contacts you first. So are you saying that for almost all patients going into the long-term care facilities, you would like to have a discussion with them because you might be able to help them? And if that's the case, do you have a lot of relationships with primary care doctors in the county that are placing the patients?
We would love to be able to have a conversation with everybody before they're placed. That's not happening now, so in lieu of that, we're starting to do new resident packets where after someone's placed, the ombudsman assigned to that building brings them a packet of information on their rights and how to contact us. And we would also very much love to have a better relationship with the primary care physicians. We have one in the North County that has been scaring the tar out of people who are married by telling them recently that they have to get a divorce or move all the assets out of their loved one's name in order to qualify for Medi-Cal, which is at least 10-year-old thinking. And so it's really hard for us to find the time in between our other tasks to get into the primary care, but that's something we're definitely working on for this coming year, and working on getting a staff ombudsman to take some of that off of my task so that I can go out and make those contacts.
Thank you.
Dr. Thomas, did you have a question or comment?
Just two. Number one, that sounds like it'd be a great newspaper article about why people who don't have to divorce to go into a nursing home, that it's not going to be financial ruin of the other spouse. Also, Karen would helped in regards to the vulnerable populations seminar that we did in September on disaster preparedness. June, sorry, time flies. And it's also a good opportunity so that when we have our disaster drills, the senior ombudsman is actually with us at the Health Agency Department Operations Center so that we can coordinate evacuation or disaster relief to nursing homes and board and care facilities. And so I think that we've found a good relationship there to continue to work on so that we can do a better job together of responding. We were in a funny situation where her organization was calling, public health was calling, and EMSA was calling, and the nursing homes were getting pretty tired of receiving three phone calls. It makes a lot more sense to work together and hopefully we'll do a better job doing it.
Well, thank you.
Commissioner O'Dell.
To the commission,
we are an area agency on aging funded group. We're part of the Older Americans Act, so we get federal and state dollars for the majority of our budget. And then we have a fairly significant county grant that makes up about 20% of our budget, and the rest comes from donations and from support for the community, some other small grants that we get.
What is the percent that you need from grants? I mean, not grants, but donations.
It varies. We had a significant donation this last year, so we're looking at an endowment at this point. But so we're kind of working out our budget figures. In the past, we've needed about 10 to 20% from donations. It's always a struggle because we don't like doing fundraising. It takes away from our actual services that we provide.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Are there any other questions? I have a question. What you said you need more volunteers. Is there training, and what kind of time commitment are you talking about?
We do have training. We have training coming up in at the end of January and beginning of February. We'll have an orientation class, and people can call us, and we'll get that information to them. The training itself is about 30 hours of classroom training and another 12 to 15 hours in facilities with other staff, ombudsmen, or volunteers for, you know, kind of hands-on training. And once they're certified, they have to be certified by the state, we ask for 2 hours a week, and they're completely flexible anytime, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, they can do their service. And as every year I ban vacations, but the volunteers continue to take them regardless, and so we're pretty flexible. We don't, you know, hold people's feet to the fire if they don't get their 2 hours in every time.
Thank you very much. Michelle Vanderland is here from the Clinica de la Clinica de Tolosa. Welcome, Michelle.
Good evening, Madam Chair and members of the Commission, and Dr. Greg Thomas and Jean. Appreciate and thank you for the opportunity and the invitation to present to you about our nonprofit community children's clinic in Paso Robles. Okay, there we go. Great. Right here. Thank you. Question. What is the number one health-related problem for children in California?
Let me go back. Do I go back? Let me try.
It was dental disease, but I love that picture of that young girl. She was just so taken back. It's completely preventable, and yet we have an enormous need in California. The fact by third grade, almost two-thirds of the children in California are affected by dental disease, making it the number one children's health problem in the state. Rather than obesity, there are over 2 million hours lost of school time, loss of concentration. It's an epidemic. The fact, among children from low-income families, almost 50% of tooth decay goes untreated, resulting in painful infections, abscesses, difficulty in speaking, difficulty in chewing and swallowing, trouble concentrating, and missing significant amounts of school. These are just some of the examples of what we see at the clinic. We see a lot of abscesses. We do a lot of extractions. We do a lot of prevention as well. And these are the older kids. We have 18-month-old babies that have no teeth. I mean, literally. And so the whole general health of the child systemically is affected. So that's why dental health is so important. It's just an overall mirror of general health of the human. The history of Partnership for the Children, it was founded in 1992. The original purpose was to receive and distribute 130,000 donated by Congressman Michael Huffington to organizations serving children in San Luis Obispo County. That was the original, how it originally started. 1998, the Board of Directors learns about the critical lack of access to children's dental services for the underserved families throughout SLO County, and then in La Clinica, we opened our doors in July of 2003. Why a nonprofit clinic? Shortage of pediatric dentists in SLO County. Of them, few accept patients covered by DentiCal or other public assistance programs, and then their DentiCal has very, very low reimbursement rates. La Clinica de Tolosa itself is located in Paso Robles, and we have our lease from the county, which is $1 a year, which we truly appreciate. It offers a full range of preventive, restorative, and emergency dental care for children. And right now, over 7,525 children have been seen, and now it's over 13,000 patient visits. So we see about 400 children per month with scheduled walk-ins, routines, and emergency visits. The staff consists of dentists, volunteer hygienists, registered dental assistants, and front office employees. We accept children from ages of infant, 0 to 13, and then foster kids from 13 to 18 years of age. We take Medi-Cal and Demi-Cal in healthy families. We also offer a sliding fee scale. And then right now we're starting to, we've always seen Head Start, early Head Start, and the migrant Head Start, but we really are working closely with EOC at this point to get those kids in at an earlier age as well. Funding, reimbursed by Medi-Cal and Dental and other public assistance programs, the sliding fee, grants, corporate donations, and local fundraising events. The sole purpose is to bridge for fundraising. The sole purpose is bridging the financial gap between clinic expenses and revenues. We do want to provide dental treatment for the underserved children in SLO County. And we truly keep this in the mission, in the forefront of all of our decisions, and that is to help ensure access to dental care for children from underserved families in San Luis Obispo County. And that stays in our minds at all times. That's about it. I've given you a fact sheet that you can look over, and if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer anything at this time. And I just thank you again for this opportunity to present.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions from commissioners? I guess you gave us all the information we need. Thank you very much. The next presentation will be by Jillian Cutshaw from the Sexual Assault Recovery and Prevention Center.
Hi, my name is Jillian Cutshaw, and I'm the Education Services Coordinator at the SARP Center. SARP stands for Sexual Assault Recovery and Prevention Center. We have been in San Luis Obispo County for 30 years this December. We were formerly known as the Rape Crisis Center, so some of you may have heard of us as that name. We changed our name in 2000, so we're now the SARP Center. We serve as the community's Rape Crisis Center, however, and we have two main goals. First of all, we try to help anyone, male or female, who has been affected by sexual assault at some point in their lives. This could be someone who experienced a sexual assault a month or a week ago. This could also be someone who experienced a sexual assault 20 or 30 or 40 years ago. We help people who are 12 and above. Another part of our services is prevention, and in doing that, we try to reach children in schools and people in the community and talk about prevention efforts. Our main service, I think, that we're most proud of is that we offer a 24-hour crisis line. It's free to call. It's confidential. People can give as much or as little information as they want, but they can reach a trained crisis counselor 24 hours a day. During regular office hours, that line is staffed by people working in the office, regular staff members, as well as volunteers. But on weekends and nights, it's staffed 100% by volunteers. So that's a really huge service that we provide, and it's done with the tremendous help of all the volunteers that we have. We usually have between 20 and 30 volunteers at any given time, men and women, Cal Poly students, community members, just anybody who really wants to make a difference when it comes to sexual assault. So that's one of our main services. We also offer advocacy services and accompaniment, which means that we will go with a sexual assault survivor to speak with law enforcement, to go to a medical exam, even to court, just to be with them so that they can have some sort of support system. We will offer counseling. It can be sliding scale. It can be free. And we offer peer counseling, so walk-in counseling with someone who's not a licensed therapist. But we also offer therapy, 12-week-long programs with our licensed marriage and family therapists. And again, that can be men or women, 12 and up, that can utilize our therapy services. We do education in the community. That's my primary position. And that starts with seventh graders. We teach sexual harassment and sexual assault prevention all the way up through college and community service clubs, all that sort of thing. We teach self-defense to women and girls in the community, again in the schools, all the way from seventh grade on up, as well as every month we teach it in Shell Beach or Paso Robles. We rotate. And these are free workshops that women 12 and above are able to attend. And we do have bilingual services as well. So that's a little bit of the services that we provide at the SARP Center. We're really there all the time for victims, just trying to make sure that they have someone they can talk to, someone to support them through the process of healing, through the legal process, whatever it is that they're going through. We rely really heavily on the community for a lot of things, of course, including donations from private individuals, from businesses, from organizations. We rely on community members to be our volunteers, to serve on our board of directors. We rely on community members to get involved in the things that we offer, such as self-defense workshops and prevention presentations. We also just rely on the community to refer their friends, their family, people that they know to the SARP Center, people who need our services that may not otherwise know about it. So we really rely heavily on the community, and we so appreciate any opportunity to come and talk about our services and let people know a little bit about that. In 2005, you'll actually find the statistics in the pamphlet I passed around, but in 2005 we had over 360 crisis interventions. What that means is people called our office in crisis, and we helped those people through that. We saw over 90 people in therapy. We saw over 3,000 people in educational presentations, and over 300 people went to a self-defense workshop. So that's about how many people we helped last year, or I guess, yeah, 2005 statistics. But it is something that everyone at the SARP Center is very passionate about. So any questions?
Are there questions from commissioners?
Oh, yes.
Commissioner Tilsher.
Out of those numbers you report in there, how many or what percentage go on and actually report to police?
Okay, a really small percentage. I can't give you a specific number, but the percentage that reports to police is very small. In 04, I can tell you that if you pulled all of law enforcement, sheriff's department, and every police department in our county, they had 117 sexual assaults reported in 2004, and that's to them. And as you can see, we have more than triple that number, and that's just crisis interventions in 05. So the percentage of people that report to police is very, very small. But some people report to police and don't utilize SARP Center services. Some people use SARP Center services but then don't go to the police, and some do both.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions?
Are there any other questions from commissioners? Well, thank you very much for a very comprehensive presentation. And now the United Way. Oh, Women's Shelter Program. I ticked you off. I'm so sorry. I meant ticked you off on my list, which is alphabetical. I guess you can almost see that it is alphabetical. Not quite. Anyway, we have Lindsay Dunn from the Women's Shelter, and thank you very much.
Sure. Thank you for having me. Well, like Jason said, my name is Lindsay Dunn. I work for the Women's Shelter Program. My official title is Prevention and Outreach Coordinator. So I do outreach presentations like this, and I'm also in charge of a very important grant called the Delta Project, or the Delta Grant, creating a prevention campaign for our community. But a little bit about the Women's Shelter Program. We have a very comprehensive program available to domestic violence victims in our community and child abuse victims. I kind of like to think of it as an umbrella program because we have so many different branches and services we provide. We have a very large counseling center. It's called CADV, the Center for Alternatives for Domestic Violence. And that's a place where domestic violence victims, children, moms, even dads can come and get free counseling or sliding scale counseling to deal with the after effects of domestic violence and violent situations in the home. We also have a legal clinic that's run by a really amazing woman, Patricia. She will help you through any legal process, legal processes that comes from a domestic violence situation, child custody issues, temporary restraining order issues, emergency protective orders, anything like that you need to do paperwork for, and she helps you out through that. Our legal clinic, we have our actual confidential safe house location here in San Luis Obispo. I think we have about 14 beds right now that if a woman is fleeing a situation, she can come to a safe place, and she's there, she's available. She's able to stay up to a couple months at our safe house location. We also have our transitional housing, which we own a couple of apartment buildings around here in San Luis Obispo. It's low-income housing, so when a family is ready to move out of their situation, they have a place to live here in San Luis Obispo for low-income housing. So we also have programs in the schools, our prevention programs that are going into elementary schools and middle schools and high schools and at Cal Poly to talk about domestic violence prevention and issues that they might see in the schools coming from home. Right now, it sounds like everyone here needs volunteers, and that's definitely something that the Women's Shelter needs too. Just like Gillian said, the SARP Center runs on volunteers, so does the Women's Shelter Program. Someone is available 24 hours a day. They call hotline. They can be connected to a live person ready to help them out of a situation, if that means picking them up off of a corner or if that means working out a safety plan to pick them up some other time. They can call hotline and reach someone on call 24 hours a day, and that's something that we pride ourselves on, too, being able to provide a service to the community that way. We also have our CHAP program, which is our Child Abuse Treatment Program. We're looking to expand that this year. We're very excited. We just hired a new coordinator for that program. So we are very excited about that, about getting our CHAP program into the schools even further and getting the word about prevention out and preventing domestic violence and all kinds of violence in kids' lives and the lives of people in our community. So. Anyone? I included the newsletter in there, so some of you might get the Women's Shelter newsletter and all kinds of brochures on the legal clinic, domestic violence restraining orders, and the Women's Shelter in general.
Thank you very much. What kind of commitment do you require from your volunteers?
We have a 40-hour training, and we just finished, actually, a 40-hour training this month, and after you finish that training, you can be on the crisis line, or you can actually work with children in our CHAP program as a child advocate, coming to court dates for them, or sometimes there's kids that just need someone to, you know, they want to go to camp, so you can be an advocate to a school camp or some kind of educational camp that you can get them into different places. But 40-hour training is mandatory if you're going to have any client contact. But if you just wanted to volunteer your time, we have all kinds of stuff at the women's shelter to do, whether it's stocking the food shelves. Right now it's the holidays, so we're swamped in toys and putting toys up on the shelves. And we can use you anywhere, even if you don't go to the 40-hour training. So.
Thank you. Are there questions? Commissioner Hetherington.
Yeah. Sure. I'm glad you asked. Well, the Delta campaign, that's actually money from the CDC. The Center for Disease Control has, in the past couple years, has decided to focus a little bit on prevention rather than intervention when it comes to domestic violence. So San Luis Obispo was one of seven sites in California that got picked to get this grant. And that was because we have had, for the past 11 or so years, we've had a domestic violence task force headed up by Jerry Shea, who's the district attorney of San Luis Obispo. And so we sit on that task force. And because we already have that task force here, the CDC looked highly on San Luis Obispo County and granted us this money. So basically what that means is we get X amount of money per year to tailor make a prevention campaign for San Luis Obispo County. We decided to go with a media campaign. Our target audience is young men, 18 to 25, so we're targeting young men on Cal Poly campus, on Cuesta campus, here in the community. It was a campaign, it's Delta, is the Delta funds, but we had an advertising team at Cal Poly come up with a slogan, which is called Beat the Punch. So our prevention campaign is called Beat the Punch, so if you ever see it out there, that's us. And we're working on a coaster campaign. We had coasters, thousands of coasters made up and distributed in local bars and restaurants talking about preventing domestic violence and what to do. We do have a really comprehensive website up right now, www.violencefreecommunity.com. So that's up. That gives a bunch of tips and ideas on how to prevent dating and domestic violence, things that that women can do, things that guys can do if they see a violent situation. We're really trying to focus on bystander apathy, because that's the biggest issue with prevention right now. We're trying to turn it into the courageous bystander is what we're going to call it. So, you know, a friend, if you see someone, you know, say something, speak up, call the police, you know, do something, don't just let it go. And so that's something that we got refunded for that, so we'll get new funding in January. And we have a coaster campaign, we have t-shirts, we have magnets, we have stickers, we have presentations, we have literature. And I can go on about this all night. But anyways, that's our prevention program. We're hoping to expand here pretty soon, you know, in the next coming months in San Luis County. So keep your eye out for Beat the Punch.
Thank you very much. Are there any other questions from commissioners? Great.
Okay.
Thank you. And now, United Way. And thank you to Kathleen Richin for being here to give your presentation.
You didn't tick me off. That was for the public comment period, not. I'm Kathleen Richin, and I am the campaign coordinator for United Way of San Luis Obispo County. I wanted to tell you a little bit about what United Way delivers as far as the community impact goes. United Way of San Luis Obispo County brings people together with a vision of building a stronger, healthier, more compassionate community in San Luis Obispo County. Yeah. Oh, I was complaining about people being too close to the coaster. But I guess there aren't many people back there left, so you can all hear me. I have a very loud voice. Together we can have more impact on the quality of life for all San Luis Obispo County residents than any one of us alone. That's the core of United Way's mission, to increase the organized capacity of people to care for one another. What if we work together to prevent problems in our communities before they happened? United Way of Slo County works with local agencies, businesses, government, neighborhoods, and individual donors and volunteers to zero in on Slo County's most pressing needs in five key areas. Meeting life's basic needs, emergency food and shelter, as well as support services for families with limited resources. Promoting healthy lives, access to a primary and preventive health care to achieve physical and mental well-being. Investing in children and youth, education and tools for our young people to become active participants in the community. Supporting work and self-sufficiency, employment development opportunities and related services to foster self-sufficiency. Strengthening our community network, create coalitions, build agency capacity, and connect people to information and resources. In 2005-06, United Way of Slo County volunteers directed more than $100,000 in Community Impact Fund grant awards to 29 local programs sponsored by 18 nonprofit health and human service agencies, many of whom were here today speaking to you about the programs that United Way has helped by funding. We also provide other services, a number of services, to local agencies and to the community that are supported by contributions from donors who recognize the value of United Way as a community asset and safety net. Some of the services include information and referral, nonprofit management advice and consultation, in-kind donation collection and distribution, You Can Help monthly e-newsletter, which is put out by Ann Shaw, our administrative assistant, who came here to give me some support tonight. Our Federal Emergency Food and Shelter Program Administration. We're fiscal agent services for local nonprofit agencies and community projects. And we have emergency grants to agencies in need. One of the projects that we have had this past year, and I presented you with the brochure on that, was an economic impact study of nonprofit corporations in Slo County. I'm going to say Slo, okay? That'll make this go faster, and you guys can get on with your business, and you can. You're tired of listening to all of us, I'm sure. The goals of the NEIS study were to document the contributions of Slo County nonprofit public benefit corporations to the economic health and social well-being of Slo County citizens through employment, revenue generation, purchasing power, service provision, and volunteer engagement. To develop public awareness about the vital role nonprofit corporations play in the economic and social health of Slo County, building community, preserving culture, and helping residents prosper. Increase and expand media coverage of Slo County nonprofit corporation needs and service issues. Increase the ability of Slo County nonprofit corporations to leverage funding to more adequately meet community needs. And to create ongoing dialogues about the social fabric of our county among government, business, nonprofits, community leaders, foundations, and residents. One of the programs that is being promoted through the nonprofit economic impact study is a collaboration forum, and that we usually have every year or every other year. The collaboration forum focuses on leveraging local information and resources such as nonprofit economic impact study, Action for Healthy Communities information, and other local data and resources to enhance grant writing, fundraising, marketing, program planning, government and media relations, and more. This year, or not this year, but in 2007, that will take place on March 1st. It will be an evening at the Elks Lodge here in San Luis for volunteers and board members. And then the next day, March 2nd, which is a Friday, there will be an all-day forum at the Oceano Community Center for the general public. So you will all receive invitations to that, and hope that you will attend. We have several projects that I would like to mention before I step down here. And one of them is the Above and Beyond project. the Above and Beyond Project, an anonymous donor was involved in our community impact grant writing process last year. And I can say this much, she, yay, women, she found the process of the community impact grant process to be so interesting and so beneficial that she put up $50,000 for matching funds. We call it the Above and Beyond campaign. And all money that we receive between now and December 31st will be matched up to $50,000. So that is a very, very exciting thing. If any of you would like to donate through cash, check, credit card, your donations will be matched dollar for dollar. And if you would like to do an EFT donation, it'll be matched 2-for-1. So if you were to send us a check for $25, you would really be donating $50. And that's from now until the end of December. Last year, there were $800,000 in requests from the community for the Community Impact Fund monies, and we only had a little over $200,000 to give out. So as you can see, the need in San Luis Obispo County is much greater than the resources that we have to provide those needs. And now I'm going to tell you about something fun. We have a Share a Tree program right now, and we partner with Target and Charter Communications and Toys for Tots to make the Share a Tree event happen. With the help of these organizations and additional volunteers, we're able to deliver fully decorated Christmas trees and gifts to families in our community who would otherwise not have them. This may not seem like much, but to the families who receive trees, it's a much needed and appreciated gift of holiday cheer. This year, we will again be delivering trees to families living within San Luis Obispo County. If you'd like to help or make a donation, please contact the United Way at 541-1234. Nice and easy phone number. These are examples of how we nurture the bodies, the minds, and the spirits of the residents of San Luis Obispo County. If you don't have any questions, I can leave or I can answer questions. If anybody wants to volunteer in San Luis Obispo County, you can go on a website, Volunteer Slow.
Is that for United Way or
it's for any volunteers?
For all organizations all volunteers. That need volunteers.
And you can call Ann at United Way if you'd like to get on our newsletter list, because she sends out our newsletter once a month, and the needs that have been submitted to us by the nonprofit agencies in the county, she puts those all together, the announcing any events that are coming up, any volunteer opportunities. Sometimes people just need, somebody needs a washer or a dryer, and the agencies are requesting those items. So if you would like to help, you can call Ann, and she'll put you on our newsletter.
At 541-1234?
That's it.
Okay. Are there any questions or comments from commissioners? Dr. Thomas?
I'd just like to put a plug in for how easy it is as an employee to do an automatic deduction that goes to support community needs and helps look at all of the needs around the community of San Luis Obispo and try and share support for those. One of the ones that's come up fairly recently for United Way, 211 is, I think we have a presentation on 211? And United Way was able to come up with a $25,000 grant to help try and make 211 a reality in this community. So they're a very dynamic organization at looking at all of the needs in the community, and I should make a disclosure that I'm on the board of United Way, so that's why I know that. Thanks.
Thank you. And how do we raise our funds?
from all of us. Is that what?
Yes.
Yeah.
From the community, and what's raised in San Luis Obispo County stays in San Luis Obispo County. We don't send our money outside of the county.
I do have a question for employers. I understand that the program works through the employer who, like Dr. Thomas said, could, I guess, automatically send deductions from employees' checks. And how does an employer become involved with this program and what's required?
Call me and I will make it happen.
All right, for all the employers.
But if you want to do an EFT electronic funds transfer, it doesn't have to be through your employer. You can call United Way and you can arrange to have that deducted directly from your checking account each month, if you prefer. But if you are all feeling generous and don't have anyone else to give to between now and December 31st, we could certainly use double your money through the Above and Beyond campaign.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
And you certainly had the last word.
Well, thank you all for inviting us. We really appreciate it.
I guess we've come to the end of our presentations for this evening. And so back to our normal business. We have a public health department report from Dr. Thomas.
Thank you. You notice there's no written report in your packet today, and that's because I am here in December to wish you a happy holiday. One thing I did want to bring to your attention is that Dr. Richard Jackson, who was the state health officer and is now working at UC, University of California, Berkeley, will be coming February 22nd to talk about the nexus between community planning and prevention of health issues, particularly the ability of smart growth principles in our planning to reduce obesity as and other social ills, such as if you can't get out and exercise easily by walking to the store, etc., rates of depression go up. Obesity, depression, and many other community ills can certainly be improved by smart growth, and he's an excellent speaker on the topic. So February 22nd in the afternoon, and I really think it'd be helpful for health commissioners to put that on their calendar if they're able to.
Where will that be held, Dr. Thomas?
I'm not sure yet. I think the library community room, but the Obesity Prevention Task Force is working with the Gold Coast Collaborative to sponsor this event, and I'm not sure whether we're going to get the library community room at this point or another location. Actually, it may be French Hospital. I'll bring the information next month.
So stay tuned to next month. But mark that date on your calendars if you can. All right. The next item of business is the Health Commission updates. Chair update. I attended the Tobacco Control Coalition, the meeting this month and in January, or actually it was the meeting at the end of November and in January, is the Communities of Excellence program. And basically what they're working on is reviewing the Department of the California Department of Health tobacco control section's requirements for a 2007 through 10 work plan, and how we're going to incorporate doing this in our county. And the group comes together and brainstorms the way for to include more community members in the planning process and potential areas of interest for the next work plan. So and that's a lot of what we did in November. And then in January, all of that data and comments will be collated, and then we'll go over that and hopefully come up with the objectives that will be in the Communities of Excellence program for tobacco prevention. And we're talking more about all tobacco, including chew, rather than just smoking cessation. So that's what's going on with the Tobacco Control Coalition. And as you all know, I went to the Board of Supervisors the day after our last meeting, and I made a statement in favor of having the board adopt the Parks and Rec element as it was presented to us by Mr. Jenny. So are there, let's see, we'll start down at this end. Commissioner Shimousis?
Nothing to report.
Commissioner Telscher?
Nothing to report.
Commissioner Hetherington?
Quite an impressive group of people headed by the DA. And Lindsay gave a good overview of the Delta program, and they're also working towards getting all of the sheriffs and the city police officers more familiar with domestic violence patterns and how to deal with the situation. So they're off and doing a good job.
Thank you for doing that. Commissioner Massey?
Nothing to report.
Commissioner O'Dell?
Yes, first, your presentation to the board was outstanding. I think you did a great job, and writing that up, it really hit all the points that we talked about. It was excellent. Thank you very much. From behavioral services, it contains two divisions, one mental health and one alcohol and drug. And many years ago, and I had personal experiences, when funding came along for alcohol and drug, that essentially split, and a schism occurred. The funding and mental health got their funding, and alcohol and drug. And throughout all counties in California, the schism occurred. And it certainly has occurred and did occur here in San Luis Obispo County. And now, though, I'm very happy to report that Karen Baylor, the Director of Behavioral Services, is beginning to bring this back together. And the problem is coexisting diagnosis and coexisting problems, which these individuals get bounced back and forth from mental health, alcohol and drug, and or maybe not served at all. But she is beginning to bring back and to coordinate these services into so that this will not be a problem to the individuals, which is a very positive program. Thank you.
Thank you for that report. Commissioner Hicks? Commissioner Garena?
No report.
And Commissioner Donnelly. Then, are there any committee reports? Commissioner Hetherington.
Just an apology to the chair for not notifying you that the legislative committee didn't meet this month. I guess I'm not used to having you at the meetings and just forgot to let you know.
I just wasted some of Dr. Thomas's time trying to figure out if I was at the wrong place. Anyway, all's well that ends well, and I assume there will eventually be a legislative committee meeting.
It will be after the first of the year. And community ed, we've been kind of working behind the scenes trying to figure out how we can get some printing money for the No Drugs Down the Drain flyer. And Dr. Thomas informed me tonight that we could go after grant money and direct it to the public health department to cover our printing costs.
Great. Yeah, I know that both you and Commissioner Garena have been working really hard on that, so thank you very much for that effort. Are there any other committee reports? Then we'll just say that next month is our agenda will include information on hospitals, nursing doctor shortages, and on the Purple Band program. Jean has been lining up our speakers, and yes, we will be having.
I know Dr. Christensen from Medical Society will be speaking. We also have confirmed the Purple Band, and I have a call to Director of Nursing at the Sierra Vista.
So we'll have presentations that will inform you. All right. I could entertain a motion to adjourn if there are no further comments.
Motion to adjourn.
Any objections? Then this meeting is adjourned, the last meeting of 2006. Thank you all very much. and Merry Christmas.
Thank you. We always have to entertain.